Is our lab going okay? Yeah, yep. Keeping up with everything? A lot to do. No denials, it is a lot to do. All right, I agree. All right. Well, let's get started on something fun. Let me get this going, too. Let's find a victim to start off with. Keep your heart rate going, constant stress. Okay. Henry Spear. Henry, are we here? No Henry, more demerits. Okay. We'll have to get a rosary, huh? Really? Something. How about Emily Stump? Emily, over here. Yes. And I'll turn off our wonderful music in the meantime for your background. Okay. So what in the scientific world excited you today, our last couple of days? Anything? We're going to keep you motivated somehow. Something that's something that was interesting to you recently? Could be health, physiology, services, life on Mars, whatever. Doesn't have to be wild. Okay, all right, that's all right. We're going to put people on the spot sometimes. I think I called on that person yesterday. Thank you. Carolyn Jenkins. Carolyn, you here? Yay, okay. Something that interested you, anything?
I read this morning that they're going to start, or they can start using, like, feathers for, like, new adhesive technology.
Oh, cool.
For, like, aerospace.
That'd be cool. Feathers for aerospace. See, there's so many interesting things out there, isn't there? So the way to keep up with all these interesting things, multiple ways, one is to go to department seminars, right? So the last couple of weeks we've had, we have two job searches going on in the Department of Biology, and one's on stem cells, and another one's on infectious diseases. And so somebody's coming today to talk at 3:30 in this room, on Thursdays, and Tuesday next week, another talk, but you can always see the seminar presentations that are usually posted outside or around or the department webpage under seminars. But it's something interesting to go to, just sit, hang out for, you know, an hour. And there's usually cookies or coffee, you know, something to pep up before you go to the library and study more animal phys, you know, so you can study right here. But what also, just don't take advantage of biology seminars, and this one happens to be on plants, right? So when you're thinking, oh, plants, how does that relate to animal phys? But we'll see today movement of ions and how channels work, and water movement. It's really not that much different from how a plant functions and how an animal functions in particular aspects. And when you think about infectious diseases, think, you know, we have to fight bacterial infections, right? How about plants? Do they have to worry about gram-negative bacteria in the soil or gram-positive bacteria in the soil? Is that of interest? Does it get into your food supply through the plants? Something to think about, right? Does it get inside of the food that then you might eat if you don't cook the lettuce? If you had just lettuce that's not cooked? Because that bacteria is out there, right? Botulinum's in the soil, too. How is it that we don't get sick every time we eat lettuce, just washing off the leaf? So it's something to think about, right? So that's what I want you to do. Think about things. It's really quite exciting. So the biology seminars are great. I would say the food and the snacks are not so great. You know, get a little coffee and some tea and some cookies. But if you go over to med school, physiology department, look up the departments over at the med school. They have some more. Yeah. And so there's biochemistry, immunology, physiology, anatomy, what else? Pharmacology. You look at their department website, and you look at their seminar listed, and it's usually every week at a particular time. Like on Wednesdays, maybe 4 to 5, or Mondays, 4 to 5, usually late in the afternoon. And if you have that block of time, just go over to the seminar. It's open to go to the seminars, right? They bring in people from around the world to talk, and they have better food. Usually they have some oranges and those little granola bar things that you can take, but just don't go in and grab it and walk in the door. That's not good. So those seminars are really good to sit and listen to for about an hour. And you can actually probably add those to your resume as well. Or you might meet people later on, and you might want to talk to somebody. Some of those people in those departments, if you're taking PGY-412, for example, human physiology, you're going to see the same faculty there. And they'll start to face recognition. You know, FaceTime sometimes is good, especially if they see you at the seminars, and then they see you in an interview later on, right? Yeah, not bad. Get the idea. Okay. So, some things to think about. And look at the different departments and look what's, you know, what they're doing. So another aspect, because I harass you all the time, every morning, every day that we meet, is maybe you want to look at some particular journals. I sent you an announcement on campus, right? Get ready for spam mail. It's going to happen. But if I can put it through Canvas, you can't block everything. It's really not, you know, it's not an email. You're wondering, is it something that's assignment, or is it something just for information? But you can go and Google, you know, Journal of Physiology or Journal of Comparative Physiology. You can go to those web pages and you can keep up with something, so you'll be able to answer questions I'm going to ask you every time we meet. And you can go over here to say get content alerts. And you just link on that and put your email in there. And then every issue that comes out, they'll send you an email with the table of contents of that issue. That's kind of cool to keep up with a particular subject that you're interested in. Right? So that's kind of neat. Another approach is to Google like Science Daily, and you'll come up with this link here, and you can sign up for a feed of Science Daily, and I mentioned that before, and you can go down to the bottom of the web page of that, and then you can sign up for an email newsletter that you'll get every day, or you can select different types of things that you want to read about. So there's always kind of neat things here. Jellyfish map, you know, Protecting Waters, Endangered Species Act, beetles, you know, and then there's space and physics, whatever you like. But just to get involved a little bit would be really quite neat to keep your mind going, seeing what's out there in science and what's being funded and what's not being funded, things like that. So remember your class outline. We're pretty much following this textbook, right? But as I mentioned to some people, any physiology textbook is going to have pretty much the same kind of content on the basic concepts, you know, negative feedback, positive feedback, how membranes work, glycolysis, TCA, electron transport chain. That's the same. It, you know, it's the same on all physiology textbooks pretty much around the world. We're pretty much following that outline, but some of you might think that these little tangents that we go over are like, was that related to anything? They are, right? I don't want to waste the time up here. So those tangents, like the pulse ox that we measured, let's just make sure we get it. What was the take home from that? Anybody remember?
Dissolved oxygen doesn't really decrease the increase of CO2 that is what triggers our breath reflex.
Right. So it was really not so much the oxygen debt, but the CO2 that builds up, which drops your pH, that then drives you to breathe, and that's really important, right? So that was pretty much the take home from that. Now, you could have an oxygen debt, but it's not the point that's really driving you to respire, right? It's that pH change. And you'll see some links that are on the webpage down at the bottom, too, in case you haven't already explored it. I know, unless it's an assignment, you don't explore it. But there's some fun things way down here. You can just scroll on down. And there's some fun things to look up, maybe that would be interesting, some things that are different. I used to have a negative pH link on there before, so that was kind of neat, but you can Google those nowadays very relatively easy, right? And find stuff. So try to follow this outline. If you're reading the book, if you're keeping up with aspects, you can read ahead. We're pretty much following these topics, or you can choose another physiology textbook and just kind of see what chapter that content's covered in, and you'll get some idea. But pretty much, I stick with the PowerPoints. So there's already three sets of PowerPoints up, 1, 2, and 3. They're on your files in Canvas if you haven't found those, but they're also at the bottom of your web page. All right? Any questions? I know some people signed up for the class late, or they're dropping and transferring. Questions? 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 Lab is cool. Do we have lab next week? No. So don't go to lab next week. Yes. Well, what are we going to do next week?
Kill our products.
Pardon?
Kill our products.
Yes, the week after that, right? We're going to be measuring membrane potential. So I want to make sure that we can get to that point in lecture two so you're comfortable with that content. So we're going to kind of start to streamline a little bit and pick up the speed on some of the content. Okay? And hopefully have some fun with some of this. So maybe you've covered this endosymbiotic theory by Lynn, how do you pronounce that? Mark Gould, in another course. Anybody know what that's about? Did you cover that in cell biology? Never heard of that concept before? Anybody got a laptop open or what do you call it? Surface tablet? You can bring your laptops, you can bring your Surface, you can do Facebooks, you can order your whatever you want, clothes online or something. But, you know, you can also have that online and then you can Google things. Let's see if anybody finds anything about this if we Googled it, for example. Yes?
Isn't this the idea that the mitochondria and chloroplasts were originally bacteria and then were able to come into human cells and then become part of that?
Right. So the idea was that bacteria and what else did you say?
Chloroplasts
were incorporated into higher organisms and are utilized. And so why did they come up with that idea? Anybody else Googling this and finding something?
The type of DNA for mitochondria has ring DNA rather than the double helix. There are other elements of the makeup of the mitochondria and the chloroplast and other potential endosymbiotic elements that are more reminiscent of bacterial heritage than eukaryotic heritage.
Exactly. So very similar, the DNA, the circular DNA, the sequence in the DNA, for example, very similar in the mitochondria that are in your body as in bacteria. And some other things that are really interesting, bacteria structure with the membrane, right, the outer membrane, inner membrane, and that structure of the of bacteria. Anybody take microbiology? Remember the bacteria, you know, gram-negative, gram-positive, and the different layers and all that kind of good stuff? Now you look at a mitochondria, kind of reminds you of some similarities, right? Yes. So, why do we bring this up? The antibiotics that people use, some of those antibiotics block the hydrogen pump. Now, how did we relate that hydrogen pump to mitochondrial function? Anybody remember?
It's used to make ATP in the electron transport chain.
Right. So that hydrogen pump pumps the hydrogen to that inner mitochondrial space, builds up a hydrogen gradient, and then because of that gradient can go down to ATP synthase, and it spins around. Remember that little movie we suggested that you look at, because some of the questions in that little movie you might see again? Yeah. Nobody should miss those questions. That is the same process that's in bacteria. So if we block the hydrogen pump in bacteria with an antibiotic, like a macrolid antibiotic, if anybody's into, remember from your maybe your microbiology course, different types of antibiotics, right, for gram-positive, gram-negative, but the macrolid antibiotics block that hydrogen pump in bacteria to kill them out. But guess what? Because of this, in bacteria, similar to your mitochondria, guess what the side effects of some of those antibiotics are? It's very obvious. It's going to hit the mitochondria and you, right? And that's exactly what happens on the side effects. Now, is mitochondria important in you? No? Yes? Maybe? Right? Yes. Right? So the side effects can be really toxic. They've taken some antibiotics off the market because the side effects are too great, because they work too well on the hydrogen pump in your mitochondria. Right? And so understanding the microbiology, understanding that theory, helps us to understand how bacteria works, but also potential side effects in antibiotic treatment to kill bacteria, because our mitochondria are so similar to bacteria. Okay, so I know this might, you know, you might think, oh, that was crazy, that's not in the textbook, but you see the integration, how important that is to understand not just the mitochondria by itself, but the whole biology, right? Pull it together with bacteria as well, and the ideas that are out there.
So cyanide, azide, carbon monoxide, you know, they can block the mitochondria. We know those are toxic. You've probably heard of the azides. Anybody work in a lab, for example, like doing research? Right? And that you might pH something. You ever pH something in the lab? Maybe some people. They won't let you or whatever. Maybe. Break the pH electrode. But you probably did that in your chemistry class, right? Do you remember when you did your calibration for your pH electrode? And you used a buffer, maybe one at 4, or one at 7, maybe one at 10, and you calibrated your pH electrodes. Does it ring a bell of nightmares back in the chemistry class? Okay. And where were those buffers? Probably up on the benchtop, right? And they just stay there year after year after year after year. Why don't they grow bacteria? Why aren't they growing a fungus in there? If you read the label on there, they actually say a mold inhibitor. And why is this important? Well, back in the generation two, my generation, back when I was your age, the big thing was waterbeds, right? And you'd even see apartments that say no waterbeds allowed because the weight, and plus they would leak and then flood the room below you and then all that kind of good stuff. I don't even know if that's a hit anymore. Is that a thing anymore? It's all about the foam mattresses, astronaut mattresses or something, right? They're probably just as costly. But at the end of the semester, what did you have to do with the waterbed? Or move out, right? You would then take that little hose and you would, you know, start it and put it in the drain or out the window. You know, that's what a lot of college kids did. Out the window into the water dripping down. But sometimes you'd get a swig of that water. Or maybe even swallow it. Just water, right? But how did bacteria get stopped from growing in that waterbed? Usually they'd give you a little bottle to squirt inside of that waterbed and you filled it up. And what was it? An azide. And so people ended up in the ER by swallowing azide when they were trying to drain their water beds. Or, on a physiological lab, for example, you use that pH electrode and you calibrate. pH 4, you adjust your pH meter, pH 7, pH 10, and you adjust it, and then you do your calibration, right? And you got this nice line, and now you can go in and measure physiological saline. So you take your pH electrode, and now you put it into your physiological saline that you want to adjust the pH to. What just happened?
Contamination.
Contamination. You've just taken that solution on your pH electrode and put it into the other one. Some of those pH electrodes are really bad because they have a plastic around them, more contamination, unless you wash it off. Right? We've had a student once in the lab, my fault, I didn't go through every little detail, but we were making a small amount of solution to measure resting membrane potential, which you're going to be doing in a cell, but we were also looking at synaptic transmission. And as we were recording for a while, all of a sudden, the resting membrane potential started to go up, started to depolarize. And I thought, oh, the electrode's coming out, you know, or something. It's not in all the way. Let's poke another muscle fiber, which you're going to be doing in 2 weeks. And we stabbed another muscle fiber, and it wasn't at a very good resting membrane. Stabbed another one, and they're all kind of depolarized. Oh, okay. Saline's messed up. Something's wrong. Too high of potassium, maybe. We'll talk about that. That's a key word right there, high potassium, depolarization. And then, so we thought, okay, let's make it again. Maybe we screwed up something. I think it was the student's first time making saline. So I went through it again. They weighed out everything right. Okay, it looks good. Balance is calibrated and everything. And then we saw how they pHed it. They pHed the electrode, make sure it was at 7, put the buffer, and then just moved it right on over to the saline and adjust the pH. I said, whoa, right there is our problem, right? And so we actually tested the new saline with the old saline on another preparation. The new saline was great. Switched out the saline to make sure if that was it. Put that in there, and then we started to see the depolarization. Killing the mitochondria, what does it do to, say, a muscle cell? You kill out the mitochondria with an azide. You don't make... We're not worried about making metabolic water. What are we worried about making? ATP. Okay, and that ATP funds... fuels, what's the most energy demanding process in your body that we talked about? Likely? Sodium potassium pump. What does that sodium potassium pump do? Helps maintain your resting membrane potential in your cells, all right? Because leak of sodium in, leak of potassium out, it resets that. So if you're having that leak all the time and the pump's not working because you don't have any ATP, you start to depolarize your cell and you're going to go to zero, right? So this is what's happened. So it's important to understand this is why carbon monoxide is very toxic as well. And same with cyanide, you know, cherry pits, don't eat cherry pits with that. And then you see antimycin, right? Antibiotic, all right? So if it's too high on some of these antibiotics, we can have problems too with these side effects because of that endosymbiotic process that we just talked about. Okay, so you might think that was a tangent, but every part of that related, right? So these tangents are trying to make you remember the concepts, not just trying to memorize it. So you don't have to memorize the cycle, but the one thing that you want to get out of this, take home with this, is that, remember that picture we showed fats, carbohydrates, proteins, right, going to make energy? So you have a fatty acid cycle, acetyl-CoA, acetyl-CoA into the TCA cycle, Krebs cycle, citric acid cycle, and you can get energy out of it. Now, the other point about the proteins breaking down, they break down to amino acids. Look at all these amino acids over here. Quite a bit, right? And they enter the TCA cycle at different points. So you get different amounts of ATP out of it. But you get the idea. You get energy not just from glucose or glycogen breakdown of glucose, but you get energy from the fatty acid cycle, right, acetyl-CoA, and you get energy from breaking down proteins. Now, your body is going to use your glucose first, but if you're starved of glucose, then you start breaking down these other components. Okay, so kind of interesting. Don't have to memorize, you know, every little detail here, but the take-home. All right. Now we think about, how about building that glucose back up, right? Because if we just have glycolysis, the product of the glycolysis is lactate, right? If we can't go to the next step, right? If we can't go on, if you're oxygen deprived, for example, then you stop with glycolysis because you can't get it into the TCA electron transport chain. If you don't have oxygen, you can't get the electron transport chain to work. So think of it backing up, right? Backing up, back up to lactate. If you can't use it fast enough, that lactate travels in your bloodstream, in your liver, and basically, not exactly, but basically, glycolysis in reverse. What did they tell you in biochemistry for gluconeogenesis? Did they cover this in biochem? Mm-hmm. Yes. Was it basically kind of like that, or a little? Maybe they went into some other details. But basically, it's lactate going back to glucose. It's kind of like glycolysis in reverse. So it's called gluco, because it's making glucose. Neo, new, genesis, making it, right? So it makes the glucose from the lactate, and that the glucose can travel back in your bloodstream and then be reutilized in cells that can use that glucose. The major organ in your body that takes up glucose after your meal is, what's the largest mass in your body probably, most likely? It gives you the most mass. Is it your brain? Is it kidneys? Is it liver? Is it what? Your skeletal muscle. Your skeletal muscle is the sink for glucose. So that can actually store quite a bit of glucose and can convert it in times of plenty into glycogen. And then you can break that down and reuse it. Your muscle, skeletal muscle, is very important in uptake of glucose. All right. How important is glycogen stores? Wow. Glycogen, kind of an interesting molecule, because then you can store it in time of plenty and then break it down when you need to, right? The problem is there's a lot to glycogen breakdown. And I don't want you to have to memorize these aspects of it, but the main take-home here is if we can't break down glycogen as a storage molecule, there are a number of diseases. This is a very old slide, and it's probably much longer than it is now, but you see that there are a number of human disorders, and also with animals, that are really quite problematic. These enzymes, for example, these kids usually die at age 2, and some other disorders. So if you can't break down glycogen, you're in some bad shape, right? There's, you know, they already know, and this is where gene therapy might be able to come in or other aspects, but, you know, you see two conditions up here usually die before the age of 2. Take home, what's take home here? Glycogen's important, right? The breakdown of glycogen's important, too, to make glucose. And the storage of glycogen, primarily in your skeletal muscles, but also in your liver. Now, everything that we just went over, all the generalization, there's always exceptions, right? Everything's not black and white. There are some helminthic worms, that can actually use aspects in the TCA cycle, or Krebs cycle, right? Or aspects without using oxygen. But I don't want to confuse you with some standardized exam, because on standardized exams, MCAT, DSAT, all that good stuff, you're going to our farm test, they're going to say, you know, TCA, electron transport, you have to have oxygen, right? So use it for their kind of exams. But in comparative biochemistry, there are animals that can use parts of the TCA cycle, electron, the TCA, acid cycle, Krebs cycle, and they can actually utilize those steps in an anaerobic environment. And so some of these worms can survive in an anaerobic environment and still have pretty good efficient metabolism, because they can utilize some of those cascades. All right. So the idea is anaerobes, as you know, and aerobes that require oxygen, like us, right? We can't survive too long. You tried to hold your breath the other day, right? Probably can't do it past 2 minutes, really. And then you have to breathe. But other organisms can live in no oxygen, basically, like Clostridium. And brine shrimp are amazing. Anybody ever grow brine shrimp? The little, sometimes they're called those little monkey shrimp, right? When you were in high school or elementary school, whenever did that. Little brine shrimp cyst. Y'all weren't nerdy, okay?
Yeah,
little things, okay?
Yeah, you grew them really
nice. Yes, because they're kind of, you have to keep them oxygenated and stuff. But you can look at those cysts, and people have done this out in the Middle East, for example, or in the Salt Lake up in Utah, and you can see these cysts that have not hatched out for over 100 years. They sit in the soil and just sit in there. Is that not amazing? And then you can take them out, you can grow them up, give them in the right water, right environment, they grow up and they multiply. What's really cool about it is you can look at the sequence, the DNA sequence, and you can see mutations over different age periods of when they became dormant, and then they can see at different points around the world when they change, and it relates to environmental changes as well. So it's really quite cool that you can rejuvenate these things that have been sitting dormant for 100 years or so. And we've talked about, like, botulinum is bad stuff, right? So at the end of the semester, when you're cleaning out your apartments, and you open up that can of soup that's been sitting in the back, and it makes that, whoosh, are you going to eat it? You. Why? It's probably been in an anaerobic environment, and it's probably growing botulism, right? So bad things. And that will end up in the ER if you try to go with that. So, yeah, that bad stuff. So remember that the TCA, electron transport chain, very efficient compared to just glycolysis. About 20 times more efficient. You might see some textbooks that give you a little higher number or a little lower number, but around that range, all right? So let's think about if you were going to stain some cells and you were going to look at the mitochondria. Let's say you found an alien creature up on Mars and you wanted to describe it, and maybe you found some neurons in it, and you had this mitochondrial stain, and you wanted to know what these neurons do. You know, why are they there, for example? And let's say these are two axons, actually. This lower one and the top one. And this is a mitochondrial stain. And you can see the brighter, whitish color means there's more mitochondria in there. Okay? And compared to the top one, that doesn't have as much. What might you come up with about these two neurons? What would you think about? What would you postulate, given the knowledge that you have? And that's the beauty of science, right? You can draw conclusions from something you know, make a postulation, and then you can go back and test it and see if it really holds true. The beauty of science is it's not stagnant, but you can build on the stuff that you have information about. What do you think? Anyone? Okay. Victims. Victims, victims, victims. It keeps you awake so you don't fall asleep. Oops.
Oh, that one just picked itself. Okay.
Let's see if we've already tortured this person. Maybe not. Morgan Seaver? Morgan? Where's Morgan? Oh, yes. Okay, the question is, here you have these two neurons stained with mitochondrial stain, right? And the bottom one's stained much brighter than the top one. What might you anticipate is different between these two neurons? Morgan, where are you? Oh, yes. What do you think? Exactly, right? So, not so bad. Exactly. Now, is it active, like, in bursts, do you think? Or is it active chronically, more or less? Probably chronically, right. And that is the case. These are actually two axons out of your favorite animal, which is crayfish. Okay, we're getting there. So these are two motor nerve axons, actually. This bottom one is a tonic type of motor neuron. The top one is a phasic type of motor neuron. And you got that right, Morgan. And this one, the animal, is this neuron is pretty active most of the time because it's helping the animal in this particular case to stand up on its legs. And so it's just like you. You know, you have tonic muscles. I know some of your tonic muscles are very weak in this class because your head falls to the side, but it's okay. You build them up throughout the class. And so the muscles like your posture muscles are tonic muscles, and that neuron that innervates those muscles to keep them firing is having high activity. And if we looked inside of those nerve endings or even in the axon, you would have more mitochondria in those axons than you would to motor neurons that are going to your phasic muscles, your fast muscles, like for jumping and shooting baskets, right? Those fatigue relatively quickly, but they're not continuously used all the time. So exactly that's it. The top one goes to phasic type of muscles that are used for fast movements, like if the animal has a tail flip, for example. But you can play with your crayfish if the lab TAs will let you, or we'll have a fun, I'll just do a demo here, or we'll have fun when we go to the labs. You can actually look at the phasic muscles, and you can look at habituation, for example, too. And you can address some other points. But just like you, if you had to jump all day shooting baskets or something, you're going to fatigue, right? You're going to fatigue. And why do you fatigue? Let's think about what is fatigue. It's related with what we're covering. It's not a tangent. It's really related. Decrease in energy.
You have to build the oxygen back up in the muscles, right?
Maybe the oxygen back up, right? And that could be it, too, the ATP, right? All right, so let's say you went, was that an entertainer? No? Okay, you're not at the option, right? All right. lack of oxygen, used up ATP. Let's say, how could we test those? Versus maybe something else, behaviorally, right? Let's say you're jogging. You go out, we're going to do a fun jog, we're going to raise some money for a group, right? And you're going to go out and jog at 5K, and you're jogging, and you're just like, I can't finish this race, right? And then all of a sudden somebody comes behind you and says, hop up, chop chop, you know, let's go, right? It's like the drill sergeant, and all of a sudden you can run, get the rest of that running going. So if you didn't have energy at all, how would you be able to have that little boost, right? So the problem is, in the attacked animal, fatigue has a lot to do with motivation, right? But you see these ultra-marathon runners, for example, that run 100 miles, things like that, and then all of a sudden they're going across the finish line and their arms are all like wobbly and their legs are wobbly and they're crawling across the finish line. Those people really hit the wall. Now, they hit the wall. All right, so how could we maybe address this, not in a human model, because not allowed to take up human legs and cut them off and do things all the time. But let's say we had an animal model, maybe like your crayfish, and we wanted to address fatigue of a tonic neuromuscular junction in a phasic neuromuscular junction. How might you do that experiment? NIH wants to give you $1 million to address this problem, and you're going to do this experiment, but you want to take away the motivation, the higher cognitive part of this. What would you do experimentally? Now, I'm getting you ready. There's a reason for this. I'm getting you ready for some open response questions. Hint, hint. Okay? So we want to think about experimental design. Okay? So there's lots of different ways to approach this. And I know some of you just said, like, your heart palpitation went on. But it's okay. So let's think about, how would we design an experiment? Let's take a little bit of time to think about it. You can talk with your colleagues. And then we're going to come up and we're going to victimize somebody with another draw.
So we're trying to figure out how to get rid of the motivation.
Are we good? Conversations are growing. Okay, so let's pick a random one here. If I can read this one. Jacob Friedrich. Is Jacob here? Jacob, over here. Oh, demerits, more demerits. Okay, demerits. Okay. Katie? No Katie? Too shy? More demerits? Okay. I'll bring in some removal demerit devices somehow. Catherine Rogers. Who's Catherine? Oh, yes. Okay.
You could... I don't know, I feel like, you know, with your example of running up behind a runner and clapping at them, I feel like that's going to have something to do with, like, hormones, like adrenaline.
Mm-hmm.
So you could measure, like, hormones like that and, like, do, I don't know, like, periodic blood tests or something while they're running to...
Let's think about non-humans, maybe.
Oh, right.
Setting up an experimental design that you could test in a lab. Like your physiology lab that you're having.
I was thinking people.
I know it's hard. Sometimes it's hard to think on your feet, right? Think about addressing questions on your feet. Sometimes it's hard to. But we're going to have such a knowledge base that you're going to be able to handle any physiology question that you're ever given. Anybody else have something that they're coming up with as a discussion group that's really motivating? You think you got the right answer? No. All right, more victims. I tell you. You're just worrying about the probability. We should do a statistical probability of your name getting picked within a day. Matthew Malesic? Matthew? Is that you? No? Somebody wants to hide? Matthew's not here. You just want to hide? Okay, demerits. I got to put your names up on a list somewhere. Okay. I'm joking. Hannah Hillard? Hannah? Is that you? Yes. You got it?
Sorry. Okay.
You didn't want it. Okay. Are you Hannah?
Yeah.
Okay.
No. So we're just saying.
Oh, we're just lucky the mic wasn't too close. Okay, so what do you think? Any ideas?
We were discussing it and we didn't really come up with anything.
Okay, alright. Anybody else? Some ideas? Well, think about what we might want to do. And you're kind of doing some of this kind of aspect. Oh, yes.
We said just an experiment, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe advice on the running wheel. Let them run for a while, let them fatigue, then put them in some type of container, let a pet or like a lizard or something like that chase them.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably maybe test the hormone balance, like she said. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And see if they maybe utilized all that energy up from that run on the wheel, right?
Yes.
In that aspect. And then you could maybe test different, you know, how long they ran on the wheel. And that could be the whole animal type of test. So that would be an approach, too. Very good. Great idea. How about we remove the whole cognitive aspect completely from it? What might you do? Good idea. Let's take this now, the next step. Let's say you see the differences between two populations, one that ran a long time and one that didn't, and then gave them the lizard. And the ones that ran a long time couldn't really respond well to the lizard. They'd come like, I'll just let the lizard eat me or something. Okay.
You could enervate the neurons yourself using some sort of electrical impulse we discussed. Yeah, mm-hmm. So that way, it's either in the natural living creature or just a part of it. It's not a motivational thing. The neuron is being innervated whether it wants to or not.
Exactly. So this is kind of, I made a little joke that you couldn't take a leg off a human, right? That little joke was a hint for you. Exactly it. You could take the muscle and the nerve out of the animal, put it in a dish, put saline around it, right? And you can stimulate that nerve and you can record that muscle. You could stimulate at different frequencies or durations of time, right? Maybe 20 hertz, 40 hertz, 60 hertz, maybe 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 40 minutes, an hour, right?
And you can see how the muscle responds. You can measure force of muscle contraction, for example. Or maybe you just want to measure synaptic transmission. You want to measure how much neurotransmitter is coming out of the nerve terminal, right? Now you've taken away the brain higher end, and you're working just with the nerve and the muscle. And let's say the muscle stops contracting. It can't keep up with the frequency after 20 minutes of 40 hertz stimulation. Where's the fatigue? Was it in the muscle for muscle contraction? Or was it in the nerve that can't keep electrical signals going down the nerve? Was it in the process of vesicle fusion and releasing of transmitter at the neuromuscular junction? Where was the fatigue? So now we go to the next step. How do we test where the fatigue is in that process of a neuromuscular junction? We've taken away the brain. Now we have a nerve and a muscle. There's a lot of activity that goes on in the nerve, the action potentials, and you have to maintain that membrane potential with what? The pump. Right? Sodium potassium pump. And now we think about, we haven't covered it all, I know, so it's a little bit out of context, but the vesicles fusing to release transmitter takes ATP. Muscle to contract takes ATP. So now we want to address where might be the energy deficiency. Next question. How are we going to step that next process up? Oh, another victim. All right. But you see, these are engaging questions, but it's all related to our content that we're covering. John Pina, did I pronounce it right? John. People have dropped, they're running from the class, okay. All right. How about Sarah Thatcher? Sarah here? I heard it. Yes? No? Sarah? Oh my God. Okay, well, I'll send out some emails. Matthew Malloy. M-U-L-L-O-Y. Matthew, come on, don't be shy. Matthew. My goodness gracious. Maybe we have to go to labs where it's required to go to labs, and we'll just take the first 10 minutes of labs and just ask questions. Okay. Taylor Decker. Taylor. Where's Taylor? Heads down. If anybody ducks, I'll know it's you. Okay. All right. Okay. See how fast this is. Oh, who knows? Maybe I got the wrong class. Gabriel, no, people are just shy, speaking up. Gabriel Collins? Oh, you see? Okay. All right, next process.
Okay, so separating nerve and muscle from each other and stimulate them repeatedly and stimulate them repeatedly and see which one something along those lines.
Exactly. Separate the nerve and the muscle and stimulate them separately. Now, how could we do that? We can stimulate the nerve with a suction electrode. We can stimulate the nerve. And you could measure the electrical signals coming down the nerve. And when it fails, you know you're not getting electrical signals down anymore. You could put electrodes directly on the muscle itself and stimulate the muscle itself to keep twitching. And that's going to cause ATP utilization. So we could address when does each of those fail independently with the frequency of stimulation, right? And now we would address, is it the muscle or is it the nerve? What do you think? In this situation, while we're looking up here, and I give you this situation because we've done this experiment, what do you think is going to happen? Now we're going to measure. Now what's really interesting, and I know we didn't get to that point yet, but I'm trying to get you to think about it. What's interesting about your favorite organism compared to you is that their muscles, some of their muscles can have dual innervation. Of a tonic type of motor neuron and a phasic motor neuron to the same muscle fiber, the same cell. Your skeletal muscles, mammalian skeletal muscles, don't work that way. You either have a fast type of motor neuron or a slow type of motor neuron in general, we'll get more specific later, to a particular muscle cell. So, innervation. Polyneuronal innervation, like in your crustacean preps in some muscles. So now you have a tonic and a phasic motor neuron innervating the same muscle fiber. Okay? So we repetitively stimulate the phasic one. And then we're measuring the muscle, either muscle force of contraction or the electrical response in the muscle. And then it drops to zero with repetitive stimulation, like 40 hertz for 20 minutes. We're not getting anything out of it anymore. Is it the nerve or the muscle? Well, all we do is turn the electrode over and now stimulate the tonic one. You stimulate the tonic one, and the muscle starts to contract again. Right? Therefore, it's not the muscle being deprived of ATP or energy, it's the nerve terminal. And if you put a little suction electrode over the nerve terminal and you monitor the electrical signals coming down the nerve, they stop. So that's kind of interesting. So it's the idea that mitochondria, back to that tangent, the mitochondria in that nerve terminal is very important for it to keep up with that energy demand.
If you can take both the tonic and the phasic one at the same time, does the muscle get out before
then? No. Then the nerve, you would see a bigger force of contraction each time, and then it will all of a sudden start to dampen, but you'll still get the muscle contraction going on because the tonic one's still in the background, still going. And actually, the tonic one can facilitate and actually cause more contraction over time a little bit more, like you lifting a weight and putting more energy behind it. So it actually kind of builds up. The tonic can maintain that. Then the phasic will drop off, either electrical response or the force of contraction, and then the tonic one keeps on going. And then you can test each one individually and find out which it is. So an undergraduate did that in the lab a number of years back, and it's kind of interesting to look at. You can also poison the mitochondria and address the same kind of questions. Here is a cross-section of these two nerve terminals. And if you look at the cross-section up here, they're not labeled when you do an electron microscopy, but you can actually label them up in other ways. You see the tonic one? All these little cross-sections, right? This cross-section here? All those little black dots around there are mitochondria and cross-section. The phasic one are the high output. You see very few of those mitochondria. You can look at them with other types of imaging. One's called, and you don't have to memorize this, but it's called Marmarsky imaging. It's a really neat technique. It kind of gives you a shadowing view. And you can see in the tonic one, look at the mitochondria. They're actually long and branched. And they're, really long, hundreds of nanometers long. So it's not those little oval capsule things that we've talked about before. In the nerve terminals, if you look at the nerve terminal of the tonic and the phasic one, look at these long, wispy little nerve terminals on the muscle. These are your crayfish muscles that you're going to be stabbing. This particular nerve terminal has a long, wispy structure, and the other one, the tonic one, has these big swellings, big boutons or big varicosities. So if you just saw that alone, if you just looked at that and you didn't know which one was labeled which, you might have, some differences thinking that one with the big varicosities, maybe they give rise to a big synaptic transmission and they can keep, that's kind of something that would give rise to a very large muscle contraction, right? But actually these give rise to very small muscle contraction, small electrical depolarizations, but they can keep going like the little Ever-Ready bunny rabbit you see in the commercials, They keep going like that little bunny rabbit, and they can, and those packed full of mitochondria, with these little wispy things on the muscle fibers, you stimulate that nerve, and it can contract really fast, but it will start to fatigue because there's a few mitochondria in that nerve terminal. Okay, so hopefully that helps you with some things. The whole idea of energy and metabolism we've talked about, you know this is kind of corny in some aspects, but enzymes help us get over that activation barrier, right, to speed up reactions that are favored, for example, but then we can lower that activation energy, so I just want to make sure that we cover that everybody's on the same page. And then we can, with that enzyme, lower that activity barrier and speed up a reaction, right? When we talk about enzymes in like the mitochondria or your cells, we're talking about, proteins. So I want to make sure a little bit, I know we're just going to go basic for a second or two, because sometimes on standardized exams they cover this type of content, and I want to make sure that you get those questions right. So peptides can be broken down by these enzymes. Certain enzymes break particular amino acids binding together, right? Some enzymes can break multiple types of bonds between amino acids. Some are specific between two amino acids. I don't want you to memorize the differences, but just that concept's there. All right, these enzymes, they're proteins. What did we talk about proteins? Temperature dependent. They're protein, right? If it's too high a temperature, it might change its conformation where it can't work. Or maybe that's the optimal temperature for that particular protein to function for structural changes, like the temperature sensitive channels in your skin, right, that sense temperature. All right, so temperature dependence, but also pH dependence. Why do you think this is so important to have different pH dependences for the enzymes that work in your digestive tract. Put on your thinking hats. What happens? Food goes in. We're all hungry probably right now. Food goes in, goes in the stomach. Generally, is the stomach an alkaline environment or an acidic environment?
It's
acidic, right? It can be like a pH of 2, not negative, but like a pH of 2. Okay, and then that helps with digestion processes. Some of the enzymes in your stomach work very well in that pH. Right? pH 2, pepsin, for example, works really well. Helps break down proteins. And now, if you had that acidic environment around cells, like on your skin, you think that acidic environment, what's it going to do if you had a pH of 2 on your skin, sitting on your skin, for example? It's going to burn you, right? It's going to damage the tissue. So how does your stomach not just get damaged in there with a pH of 2 floating around there? You have a mucus layer in there. It's barrier. It protects the stomach. We're covering that when we go into GI, just kind of free living here. And that keeps this pH environment from touching those cells and destroying those cells that then would give you a bleeding ulcer, right? What destroys mucus environment? Chemist had organic chemistry. What might destroy a mucus environment? What kind of substance? But sometimes you...
Soap.
Pardon?
Soaps.
Soap. All right. Don't eat soap. When your mother tells you to force out your mouth, bad idea. Okay. What's another substance that you might indulge in if you're over 21? Okay. Alcohol. Bad stuff, right? In the sense of taking away that mucus layer, and then you're eating food, all the chips and nachos and all spicy food and all that good stuff. And the next day, my stomach's really burning, all that good stuff. And you keep doing that all the time. College age kids keep doing this all the time. And then they end up with a bleeding ulcer. Why is it a bleeding ulcer? What we just covered. Okay? So that can happen too. Right? You don't want to destroy that mucus layer. So alcohol will destroy that mucus layer. And then you eat food, and then you have that acidic environment right on the tissue that's you want to really protect. But in a normal situation, then, that food goes through and is dumped into the small intestine, the duodenum. And then in that duodenum, a lot of other solutions, we'll talk about that later, are injected in there, like bile salts from your liver and gallbladder pushing out. And then that neutralizes that environment. Because what do you want to do in your intestines? You want that food to touch those cells so you can absorb the nutrients, right? So you need contact. But you can't do that at a pH of 2. So now a neutral environment protects that cell environment, but now different enzymes work to break down that food product. You get the idea. It's very important to understand where proteins work at optimal. Enzymes are proteins, right? So some of these proteins really require metals, too. So these are called cofactors. So if you're zinc deficient, for example, you might have a problem. You might get drunk pretty easily if you're consuming alcohol and you're zinc deficient. So put zinc tablets in your beer. No, I'm joking. Don't do that. Alcohol dehydrogenase, people that have the zinc deficiency aren't going to make that enzyme well, and then you're going to have a real problem with this. Okay? And you see that, don't try to memorize this, I just want you the general points, is that these metals are important to have enzymes functioning correctly, and different metals. So this is why you hear people with not having the right diet, for example, can really end up in quite some problems. And you can relate maybe to the alcohol dehydrogenase. What's another one that's very important? Ooh, look at that one. CA as an abbreviation, carbonic anhydrase. What does it do? Remember what it does?
So it breaks down CO2 into hydrogen and sodium bicarbonate.
Right. So CO2 plus water, hydrogen ion, bicarb, does it always go that one direction? Which way do enzymes work always? Or not? Or what? It can go both directions, right? And it's important it goes both directions, and we'll cover that in respiration. So, this is very important for your pH balance, right? And working on cells. Okay, proteins, about a half of your mass of cells are really proteins. Just really quickly that you've heard these terms, primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary, and we'll go through it really fast. Primary, just your amino acids in a straight structure, right? Secondary, alpha helix, right? Beta-plated sheets, like keratin. And then, nails, for example. And then tertiary structure,
When you have like a disulfide bond and it folds around itself and you have two cysteines and the sulfide bond can be in there and be real strong, a covalent bonding, and it keeps that structure of that protein, for example. So tertiary, why I bring this up is it appears on standardized exams sometimes. So I want to make sure that you've got those terms. Hemoglobin is a great example of a quaternary structure where you have different proteins coming together to make a functional unit like hemoglobin. So four globular proteins together. Myoglobin in your muscle. Question that's been on exams in the past. Is it a quaternary structure? Tertiary structure? Secondary structure? Primary structure? Probably not a primary structure. And I know it's a little bit hard to think because we haven't gotten to it yet. Myoglobin takes oxygen and can pull it into your muscle fibers. What did you say?
Quaternary?
No. It's a good guess, though. Tertiary. So you would try that. It's a single unit. It's like a quaternary. It's like one of these units out of a hemoglobin. And it binds oxygen stronger than hemoglobin. That's how it pulls oxygen out of your blood into your muscle. Right? It can take... It's a sink. So it's not a quaternary structure. That has been missed on people coming back and said, oh yeah, I got that right because I remember that in 350. Great. Okay, we have a few more minutes. Let's get rid of this one. Okay. Torture you some more stuff. Okay, so membranes. We're cruising. This chapter is not so involved, but some really main concepts that we want to make. Membranes in your bilipids, in your neurons, for example, in your heart, all these cells in your body have a bilipid membrane, right? Bilipid. Two sides to it. Very thin, but they keep the differences from the inside and the outside of the cell, right? And a lot of those differences are maintained by proteins, pumps, ion channels, right? So the inside of the cell is different than the outside of the cell. If you just poked a cell and you had it in your body and you had an open hole in it, that cell would probably die, depending on the cell. So cells impermeable to passage of most water-soluble molecules. We'll get into some more details about it, but you've probably seen this picture if you've had cell biology. Really important, because this is the fluid mosaic model, right, of a bilipid membrane. So phospholipids with their hydrocarbon tails, right? Cholesterol, these little ghosts that are in the bilipid here, and these big proteins that can be on one side are go through the membrane, ion channels, and then these saccharides, kind of side changes, are glycoproteins that we might refer to in other classes too, and we're going to understand a little bit about this that you had in your first assignment as well. Okay, so what this membrane, we want it to be mobile. We want it to be able to expand and maybe, you know, have the cell shrink up a little bit, right? How do you measure your osmolarity in your body, for example, when you're thirsty? Remember that? Right? You're thirsty, you drink water. What's going to happen? You fill up your water. What happens to your osmolarity in your blood? If you dilute the salts with water, does it decrease or increase? It's going to decrease, right? Because you diluted the salts. So what's going to happen to a cell if you had, let's say your hand's a cell, and well, the primary example, right? A red blood cell, you put it into seawater, what's going to happen? Ocean water, high salts. High salts on the outside pulls water out, right? You take that red blood cell, you put it in distilled water, what's going to happen? Red blood cell has some salts inside of there, but distilled water has none, so which way is the water wanting to go? Into the cell, right? So it swells and busts, right? That's why you can't have an IV with distilled water, right? So not good. So the same idea in your body for your neurons that detect osmolarity, it's the same idea. It swells and shrinks. And in that membrane, you have stretch-activated ion channels. So that can cause that neuron to start firing, action potentials, because it can open up, sodium can go in, or some ion can go in, depolarize the cell, start an action potential, dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, and you can tell your osmolarity of your body. That is really cool, right? So that membrane has to be, you know, a little bit flexible, right? So that's really important. Okay. So some of the main concepts to remember, then these polar heads and these nonpolar tails, this region, this long carbon chain, You see here, this is a one chain is saturated and the other one's unsaturated. What do I mean by this? Saturated is with hydrogen ions. So this is saturated. This side's saturated. This side's unsaturated. It doesn't have all the hydrogens it could have because there's a double bond here. What did that double bond do to that bilipid membrane? It caused a kink, right? And if you have little kinks, is that going to make it more tight with the van der Waal forces, or is it going to make it weaker with van der Waal forces, do you think?
Weaker.
Weaker. So you've increased membrane fluidity. Right. Okay. Also, something else to remember. The length of those carbon chains. What if we had some that were short, we cut this off, and we had some that were long? Some short ones and some long ones. Would that increase membrane fluidity or decrease membrane fluidity? Probably increase it, right? So these are the way the membranes can change their structure to increase mobility because it's necessary to keep the proteins to be able to function in there, or decrease it. Now, the one that's confusing is cholesterol. And I admit, it is confusing somewhat. And generally, there's literature out there, and it's in your cell biology book. I have it on the bottom of our webpage, if you cruise on down, that where you can load up a erythrocyte, a red blood cell, with a lot of cholesterol, just load it up tremendously in an unnatural way, and the membrane mobility will be increased because you've broken up so much of the van der Waal forces. But under a general physiological range, generally, if you have a little bit of increased cholesterol, you can sometimes decrease membrane fluidity. It depends on the cell. It depends on the organism. In some cases, it might not be statistically significant, but they see these animals that live in different environments. But in some general textbooks, you will see this, that an increase in cholesterol will decrease membrane fluidity, but within a physiological range. How to remember this to keep it where you're not confused? Think about going to help out a science fair, and you're going to go into an elementary school. What happens with all those little kids, right? You can't move, right? You just can't move around. So think of those little kids as cholesterol molecules and your mobility. You can't move, all right? So that's maybe one way to think about it. But it depends on the particular cell type that we're talking about. Okay, so there we covered this. So we've covered osmolarity as well, but the osmotic pressure we're talking about is the drive of water to go to the higher osmolarity side. Now, when we talk about hydrostatic pressure, this becomes more important when we talk about the kidney, for example. The pressure it would take to push that down to keep it from rising, we can measure that, right? And you can measure that as hydrostatic pressure of that, like the red blood cells swelling up or shrinking. You can do these experiments with adding osmotic pressure by increasing the concentration of sucrose, for example, in a solution. You can see the osmotic pressure will increase. Animals can actually change their amino acid concentration to handle the cold environment, for example. They can change their osmolarity in their hemolymph. Let's talk about insects, for example, the cold environment that we have out here. And they want to avoid freezing. So what do you think the beetle out there that's exposed to the environment on cold days, it's getting towards winter, and they want to avoid freezing, would they raise their osmolarity or would they decrease their osmolarity? What do you think happens to avoid freezing in these insects? What would they do? Ideas? Anybody? Entomology people here? No entomology people? No one's interested in insects. So cool. Drosophila is the second favorite organism. They're tying these days. Crayfish. Any ideas? Increase it. How many think increase? How many think decrease? Again, how many don't care? Okay. All right. So, yes, that would increase their osmolarity. It's no different than adding the salts on the road to decrease the freezing point, basically, right? Breaking up the water, in a sense, but also changing osmolarity. If you change the osmolarity, you decrease the freezing point of that solution, right? Because you're breaking up the water from making it ice, right?
So the idea is that they will actually increase particular amino acids. Proline is a key one. They will actually increase the concentration of proline in their hemolymph and increase their glucose levels in their hemolymph to avoid freezing. That's pretty cool, right? So you get the idea that it's important to understand these factors. But now what have they done? They've changed their osmolarity. Uh-oh. What's going to happen to the cells? Higher osmolarity outside, might they shrink a little bit, right? So maybe that's a problem. How much can they increase it before the cells are damaged? Or do they do something unique? Do they maybe increase the osmolarity inside the cytoplasm as well to kind of match the hydrostatic pressure that'd be across the membrane? Kind of interesting. Some animals can actually increase the cytoplasm concentration of the salts as well. But not too much. But what would happen if you change the salt concentration or the changes inside the cell? Think of all those enzymes that we just covered. Glycolysis, a whole bunch of enzymes. The mitochondria function, all the protein machinery, right? That needs to go on, all those enzymes to make proteins. And now we could change the environment for those enzymes to function, right? Because that salt could change the conformation of those enzymes. So there's a lot of balance that goes on. And this is what people study, like in comparative physics. Okay, so some take-home messages here. Generally, I don't want you to memorize these values right now, but we will memorize the human values later on when we get to renal system and respiratory. But generally, inside the cell, low sodium, high potassium, low chloride, and proteins. That's just what this is usually referred to. Some textbooks might be PR with a negative sign, or usually just anionic charges with a not minus sign, an A with a minus sign. Because generally, proteins have a negative charge, right? So you might see these to be quite harmful. We just talked about proteins half the cell mass, right? So that all fits. On the outside of the cells, higher sodium, higher calcium, and chloride's high. So usually the sodium chloride is about equal. Now, it's not always the same, but in general, right? The numbers, I don't want you to have to memorize right now because it depends on the cell. It depends on the organism. Seawater invertebrates, like the squid, the ocean's very high osmolarity, right? Well, actually, their blood, their hemolymph, their extracellular fluid in their body is very close to the seawater, actually, so that's pretty cool. And seawater is very high in osmolarity, much higher than this. But the ratios of these ions hold to be the same. Is that they're relatively higher potassium inside the cell and higher proteins. So how to remember all this? Oh, gosh. You think I'm sweating for the exam, right? Sweat runs down, and you're sweating, and you taste it. What does it taste like? Anybody exercising here?
Salt.
Salt, right? It tastes like table salt. What's table salt made out of? Sodium chloride, right? Outside the cell, outside the body, taste, sweat. Okay, you get the idea. That's a way to memorize these corny things. And calcium is generally higher outside the cells as well. Depending on the cell, usually much, much higher. Maybe even 10, maybe inside the cell it might only be 10 to the minus 6 compared to the outside. So it depends on the cell with calcium, but generally calcium is higher outside the cell than inside the cell. Okay. So the idea is that you can see these values right here. Crabs, invertebrate, squid, we just talked about. Look at the external concentrations, very high. But internal concentrations also much higher than, say, the frog, amphibian. But the ratios, you still see that sodium's high on the outside compared to the inside. And the potassium's higher on the inside compared to the outside. So crabs and squid, invertebrates, you can actually have freshwater crabs, you can have saltwater crabs, or crabs that will be more of an estuarine area and not so salty, but they can actually, there could be a range with some of these invertebrates. But generally, amphibians are much like mammals, so we'll cover that later on. But just the main concepts that we just covered. We already covered red blood cells and what would happen with those, for example. Now you think about these ions moving across cells real quickly. Passive diffusion means what? Doesn't require energy, right? Passive diffusion, no energy. What an example would be passive diffusion across the membrane? What did we talk about? We're blowing off something. CO2, right? I'm losing weight. I'm breathing faster, faster, faster. Alright, so CO2, gas molecules can go across the bilipid membrane, right? Non-charged molecules, for example. Water generally doesn't just go across the membrane. Ions aren't just going to go across the membrane. They have to go through an ion channel. Then we have passive transport, such as with an ion channel. Now, these channels we'll talk more about. Them. Some of them are voltage-gated. Some of them aren't. Some of them might be what they call channels because they can allow ions to go across. Then we have carrier-mediated transport. We have a secondary, this is important, a secondary type of active transport. It's exchangers. Generally, exchangers don't require ATP themselves, but if you set up a concentration gradient due to our favorite pump over here, now we can drive an exchanger, right? If you pull potassium out of a cell, right? I mean, if you pump, got it just back. If you pull sodium out of a cell and you pump potassium in, you have a potassium gradient, a high potassium gradient on the inside of the cell, right? If you had an antiporter that would allow potassium to come out and maybe something else to go in, that would be driving it, right? So that's kind of interesting to pay attention to. So what we call a secondary active transport, it's set up by a gradient from the pump, and that allows it to function. If the pump wasn't there, then that wouldn't set up the gradient, and it couldn't function. How you could tell passive diffusion from an active process or needing a channel, you could keep adding that substrate, right? And you can see what goes across. If it kept going like that linear line up there, passive diffusion, gas, right? Just like this room, if the bell rang, we need bells to keep you on time. But if the bell rang and everybody wanted to run out right away, what happens at that door? We got a log jam, right? You can't get all out at the same time. So you're going to saturate the door. You're going to saturate that channel. So we have a saturation going on, right? So you can actually see how many ions can go across the cell membrane or molecules across if they're being transported or they're going through an ion channel by looking at the saturation. Generally, this is still a question. There are people that dedicate their whole lives to understand how ion channels work. Is that not amazing? Aren't you lucky? You know, you're not doing that, right? And why they do that is very important because they look at ion channels, mutations in ion channels. They look at pharmacological agents to understand how ion channels work, which is important for health and medicine. But there's still debates. If an ion, like a sodium, goes through the channel with water around it or not, does it strip off the water? Or does the water follow through behind the sodium molecule? Isn't that wild? Do people actually worry about those kind of things? So those are kind of interesting, too. And it's important for water balance with the cell. Now, carrier-mediated, you know, so kind of like a flipping of the protein. But you hear these terms, too. Antiporter, symbiporter, uniporter, okay? Symbiporter going the same direction, antiporter, one going the opposite, like we just talked about, like if potassium is going out and something else is going inside the cell. General terms. The pump, they remember, it's 3-2, sodium, 3-2 sodiums, but generally, it's not just 3-2, right? It depends on the cell, but the general idea is 3-2. And it takes ATP for the pumps. Okay, so this is important to understand how ions might, or how amino acids might go through a cell. And if you haven't already looked at the test bank that's on your Canvas, you see questions related to this, right? And so you might want to start going through the test bank and looking up some aspects. So here's time. And here's the intracellular concentration of alanine. If you use no sodium on the outside, very little alanine goes on the inside. If you now allow, you have sodium on the outside, and now you measure alanine going across, what happens? A lot goes across. So what do you predict? It is probably a co-transporter, right? Is that important? Let's see how important that might be. What's the number one loss of life around the world? Potential, so here's the keyword, the potential loss of life worldwide. What's the primary cause of it, do you think? Worldwide, the potential life loss of life. What do you think it is? Not just here in Canada, but loss of life worldwide.
Dehydration.
Tuberculosis. Dehydration. Diarrheal diseases, mostly from the lack of clean water. Wow. Isn't that amazing? Why is it a potential life?
because a lot of children die from diarrheal diseases. You dehydrate. It's the number one loss of life worldwide. Of potential life. So we actually have looked this up. So there you go, loss of potential life, right? And you can actually measure this. People measure that, and they actually look at it in different ways. And there's organizations that measure that, and you can see how your country fares compared to other countries as well. And that relates to structure, governmental care of water supplies, and things like that. And you can look at the population per 100,000, for example, and see where we fit. Okay, cholera. Cholera is really bad, right? Drink bad water, you got cholera. Remember, if you studied ecology, they used to do this. You go up to the cemetery, and you looked at all those cemetery plots at the Lexington Cemetery, which is a historical place. Do you still do that? And look at all the death rates? And was there a certain death, high percentage at a certain time? Anybody do that in ecology? It was with a cholera outbreak. And it was really quite amazing, because so many people died with a cholera outbreak right here in Texas. And why do you die of cholera? You die of cholera because you have diarrhea about 10 liters a day. You're never going to get off the john, right? 10 liters a day. Wow. You can keep drinking water, but 10 liters a day just keep coming out. That's a lot of water. Think of a liter, 10 of them. What's the first primary treatment for it? So simple.
Water with sub up to a bunch of salt mixed into it.
Water with salt and glucose saved millions of lives. Millions of lives, something so simple. Water, a little bit of amino acid, and glucose. Why? Because when it goes in the GI tract, semi-porter, glucose, amino acids, what's going to follow? Water. Stops the dehydration, stops the diarrheal attack. Saved millions of lives, something so simple. Grandma's recipe. Right? Wow. So think about it. It was really important to understand that. Once they realized they could save millions of lives, a lot of that came out of India, then they actually wanted to investigate more of the mechanisms, and they found out it was a co-transporter. It was really quite amazing. So you can look up dehydration and cholera. First treatment by Red Cross is water with glucose and some amino acids.
The video on the thought... Uh-huh. The lecture, or is that...
Yeah, it's on the webpage.
Okay. Mm-hmm.